coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Farmers are ramping up for a new season and may be making some last-minute changes based on issues like the Iran war and tariffs.
Farmers definitely do change their planning decisions based on market shocks in the input market, like what we're seeing now.
We take a closer look at the ag landscape as spring takes hold in the first state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also visit a prison arts program that helps inmates prepare for reentering society. Arts Playlist previews the Southern Delaware Chorale's latest concert. And Enlighten Me offers some backyard gardening tips. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It's the start of a new season for farmers in the first state. And as they look at what to plant and how to budget to have a successful season, they are navigating several issues. And some of those issues are out of their control, including the impact of the war with Iran and tariffs. This week, Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale delves into those issues with University of Delaware Cooperative Extension Farm Business Management Specialist Nathaniel Bruce to better understand how Delaware farmers are coping with this period of volatility in the ag industry.
Can you tell us what sorts of things in the business perspective that a farmer is typically concerned with day to day, month to month?
Definitely markets every single day. You know, what's the price of my product going to be when I sell it to an end user? You know, as a producer, you don't really, as a farmer, you don't really have control over that, you know, over what the price is going to be. You do have control over what inputs you have, you know, things like fertilizer, you know, pesticides, herbicides. You do have some control over those inputs, but you do not have control over what that market price is going to be. You know, and that's not just commodity crops, but that's also processing vegetables and things like that as well. So that's always the big concern. You know, am I going to be able to cover all my expenses at the end of the growing season? That's always on a farmer's mind.
And from a perspective of policy that is affecting Delaware farmers, what kind of stuff is putting pressure on them right now?
Oh boy, that's a big question. Yeah, right now the war in Iran, we'll start there, is really having a big impact on input prices. You know, a lot of the nitrogen fertilizers, they require natural gas to be used in their, you know, to manufacture them. So the war and its impact on, you know, global trade, that's really having a big impact on nitrogen prices. I mean, urea actually went up over $150 a ton the day that we attacked Iran. So that, you know, that has a really big impact on a farmer's bottom line, especially if they're raising a crop that's pretty intensive in nitrogen like corn, which is really one of the biggest staple crops here on the shore because of our poultry industry here. So that's really a big challenge that they face. As far as policy goes, one of the biggest things that has been discussed recently from Washington, D.C., but that is about expanding ethanol usage throughout the year and, you know, trying to have E15 through the summer months. If that passes and that becomes a reality, you'll definitely see the price of corn. It may have a really big impact on that price. It might raise our futures prices quite a bit. So that's a big policy thing moving forward. And then another thing that's kind of another market that's developed in the last couple of years, particularly out of the Midwest, is renewable aviation fuel from soybean oil. And that's something that's gathering steam, that's catching on. But there were some policymakers that enabled that to happen, and that's a market that's maturing.
Sure. And so nitrogen not being used in corn, or being used in corn but not being used in soybean, can that influence a farmer's decision on what to plant?
Yes, absolutely. And The market situation right now definitely implies that that's going to be the case. So next Tuesday, the United States Department of Agriculture, they release a report every year called Prospective Plantings. And what it tells us is what where are farmers across the country, where are they, what kind of crops are they planning on growing? Where are they going to go? Are they going to plant predominantly corn, predominantly soybeans, things like that, cotton, whatever it is. Last year, there was 8 million more acres of corn planted across the country than the previous marketing year. So already, we're going into this marketing year with way more production last year and a lot more corn in storage than we've had since 2018, 2019. So, it's already looking like there's going to be a big surge in soybean prices. And then you throw in an increase in nitrogen prices. Now it's looking like that may even more, it may look like it's probably going to be that way for sure now. And when you have an increase in supply like that, you're definitely going to see lower prices. So there's a lot of concern in the farming community about soybean prices and what could happen there. But yeah, farmers do, long story short, that's a big answer for the question, but farmers definitely do change their planting decisions based on market shocks in the input market, like what we're seeing now.
And how far ahead of time does a planning decision need to be made?
Oh man, they definitely farmers might actually go to the last minute before they decide. Now they obviously have to buy their inputs from their supplier, but maybe a month or two prior to planting, they need to make that decision because they need to get the fields ready and prepped. But I've seen some farmers change on a dime too. But there's definitely an opportunity cost if you do that because you might miss time for the fertilizer to become active in the soil. You might have missed time where herbicide spray to kill off the weeds might have been active. There's definitely a downside to switching last minute, but you do see it occasionally, and that's not really common.
And while you're talking about fuel and ethanol too, we can talk about fuel prices. All of us are seeing kind of higher prices for refueling our fuel tanks and everything, and I imagine, does that impact the farming community more so?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, diesel prices, you can see, diesel's even higher than gasoline and what we put in our cars. So think about all the farm equipment that, we get stuck behind on the highway. All of that runs on diesel and, fuel costs. I mean, that's going to be a huge increase in a production budget this year. And even too, it's not just the equipment, but it's also irrigation. We have a lot of irrigation units on the shore that are powered, through like a diesel generator, like a diesel engine. So just to even water a crop for some producers can become more expensive this year. So that's something that really has a lot of farmers concerned right now.
While we're talking about wars, there's the war in Iran, but there's also the trade war in China. How has that ongoing affected farmers here in the United States?
So the soybean market is pretty much dominated by China in purchasing soybeans. So China has a huge demand. If you were to chart it out, China's demand for soybeans in the last 20, 30 years, it goes up, right? The U.S. soybeans have always been the source for China historically. Now we have competition from South America, particularly Brazil. And Brazil's soybean acreage has gone up and up and up. And now China is starting to purchase more Brazilian soybeans than they are American soybeans. And one of the big things is tariffs have are a big reason for that. So if we did not have tariffs and we had true free trade, US soybeans would be cheaper for China to buy than Brazilian soybeans, about $1 less per bushel. But because of tariffs, it's cheaper for Chinese importers to buy from Brazil than it is from the US. And we saw this back during the first administration in the first trade war. And, what ended up happening was the total amount of soybeans we had in supply reached a new high level during that time period. We are not there currently right now. Even with all the tariff news and everything that's there, China's demand for soybeans today is a lot different than it was in 2018. They need soybeans, and they have made some small commitments and some purchases from the U.S., but it hasn't been enough to really move that market. I mean, Brazil is really cutting into that market, into the export market, and even other South American countries like Argentina and Paraguay are also there as well. The good news on soybeans is the last marketing year, 51% of our total soybean production remained here domestically. That was the first time that we've ever had that happen. There are some ag economists that predict, with some of the expansion and like soybean crush facilities, if you were to plot it out, going out to 2030, 2035, there's going to be enough domestic demand where, China is still going to have an influence on the market, but it's not going to be to this extent. So there definitely is a light at the end of the tunnel, if you will, on the soybean market in the US.
Yeah, you said that the soybean demand is not what it was in 2018. It seems like there's a lot of stuff that wasn't the same way it was in 2018, and yet the Farm Bill is still using language from 2018. Can we talk about what's going on with that too?
Yeah, that's something they're talking about getting a farm bill out this year, a skinny farm bill. And it's not gonna one of the big things is there were a lot of things that came out in the big beautiful bill that address like farmer safety net programs, including payments to producers. So a lot of things that might have happened in a farm bill occurred in the big beautiful bill, which is kind of unusual as far as ag policy goes nationally. Yeah, they are working on a new farm bill for this year, and according to politicians, they call it a skinny farm bill. May not have too many big new things compared to the 2018 farm bill, but we'll see. I mean, that's something that's been kind of, information on the new farm bill has been kind of scant, if you will, just that it's been in that there's been some discussions in different committees. One of the biggest, I would say the biggest benefits to farmers in the big beautiful bill was that the subsidies for crop insurance, because crop insurance is federally subsidized. So the federal government, there's a bunch of layers in crop insurance where there's different entities where if a producer pays for insurance, it finally reaches them if they have an insurance claim. So there's a lot of different layers, but it is federally subsidized. One of the biggest positive impacts on American agriculture in the big beautiful bill was the subsidies for crop insurance increased. So the one input that went down in cost this year for farmers was their crop insurance. And some of the pro there's some crop insurance products that are really useful that have always been too expensive for a farmer to justify purchasing here. Because of the increase in subsidy, some of those products, and they're called enhanced coverage option and supplemental crop option. Like, for example, those two products, the subsidy increased from 65% to 80%, which is, pretty significant. But those products have now become more affordable for farmers to select. And, now they can, they could cover their losses up to 95% of what they would expect to get, revenue wise. So that's pretty big. And that is really the biggest impact from the big beautiful bill. That's a real big positive for farmers across the country.
Thanks to University of Delaware Cooperative Extension Farm Business Management Specialist Nathaniel Bruce and our Israel Hale for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. Delaware Public Media's Benta Boutier takes us to the Howard R. Young Correctional Institution in Wilmington to learn how the arts are being used to help incarcerated individuals on the road to re-enter society. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware's Department of Correction aims to expand the options it offers to people incarcerated at its four state facilities. One is a pilot arts program at Howard Young in Wilmington, run by Rehabilitation Through the Arts. Delaware became the third state to participate in this program when it launched at Howard Young 10 weeks ago. This week, five men graduated from that program, and Delaware Public Media's Ben Tabutier sat in on their final class to learn more about this program and what it provides.
Yep. What's the next one? Anyone remember?
Class at the Maximum Security Howard Young facility for a new pilot program, Reimagining Myself, kicks off with a fast-paced game that's played in a circle.
Pow! We got the pow, right? What does the pow do?
The class, held twice a week since January, starts this way most days. Instructor Kate Kenny reviews game rules.
Yeah, how do I block a pow?
The men told instructors they couldn't have seen themselves participating in a game like this before, but participation is enthusiastic now.
Everybody's least favorite one I heard. What's the right, right, do? Right. Focused eye contact, energized. Whoosh!
The program is voluntary and geared to men 6 months to 2 years from release to help prepare them for reentry. Jesse Jameson, one of the participants who you just heard in the game, gave us permission to identify him for this story. He has about 2 months left on his sentence.
I wasn't always a person that speak out or a person that participate in stuff like that. I was always shy or didn't want to be on spotlight. I could say for me, this class helped me be more open, be willing to help others, be willing to be creative. Don't be shy, you know, if you have to give a little bit to get a little bit.
DOC has one other major prison arts program based at James T. Vaughn Correction Center, which promotes rehabilitation through painting, drawing, and watercolor. The Howard Young facility is the latest to buy into the RTA class, joining California and New York. Kenny says her program is based on cognitive behavioral therapy practices.
The program is really entirely focused on the social and emotional aspects of reentry. The idea is to lessen some of the surprises and potential challenges that people might face, knowing that we can't solve all of those in a 10-week period. But at every point, the program has been infused with the lived experience of people who have made the transition from incarceration back into their communities.
The class warm-up has done its job. Kenny and her co-instructor, Joshua Holmes, move to more serious material now. Holmes shows a video with interviews from men speaking to their experience of incarceration and reentry. He takes the men through materials that ask about plans and thoughts for reentry.
Even before moving, like, you look at yourself right now, right? Seriously, look at that amount of progress that you made, you know, through this, but this introducing you much more to you, right?
Holmes is an artist in Wilmington who was previously incarcerated at Howard Young himself. And since today is the group's last session, he asks the men to reflect on their time in the course and at Howard Young.
Stands out to me live precisely for today and look forward to tomorrow because you must. This is going to end too. That's coming too. It's coming. It's coming. This is critical, critical, critical information.
Here's Michael Redman, another man who gave us permission to identify him, answering Holmes' group prompt.
Reimagining yourself, reinventing yourself is important because we got kids, we got people that live up to us, we got family, we got lovers.
Art comes into the program through personal storytelling and performance-based exercises that help people in the course to reimagine themselves. Today is kind of a graduation for the group, where they recite a poem, adding physical interpretation for the words.
That activity is called poetry in motion. Okay, poetry in motion.
So everybody has to speak at least one line.
The men assign stanzas and plan their moves.
So we all pop out. We all just pop out while the other one falls.
They rehearse for a few minutes.
Reimagine your imagination, educate your ideas.
And Kenny tells them it's time to show what they've come up with.
Welcoming to the stage.
Four heartbeats.
Here's Redmond's part of the performance.
Let's imagine with a different set of eyes, paint portraits of lyrical love.
Again, Holmes and Kenny debrief. Holmes says the men probably won't be asked to perform poems or dance during reentry, but they exercise practical skills.
And that's what y'all just did, demonstrated an act of what?
Unity.
That's all y'all did. Mm-hmm. It was cute. It was, like, you know, but you don't even be seeing these things, though. You see what I'm saying?
Redmond says he gets it.
To teach you how to play your part, too. We all had a different role to play, and we followed that role.
It reminds Jameson of his neighborhood's effort to shovel snow off the street.
We all came here. I was like, yeah, let's knock this out. We all live in this neighborhood. We all got to drive in and out. Our kids live here. Let's all get it together and get it cleaned up. So I like that. That was the first time I actually did, like, community work together. Came together. Like, a lot of people you don't even talk to in your neighborhood. But when you got work like this, they come out, everyone pitch in.
The RTA program will continue, as DOC says it committed to running at least 3 cohorts. The next round will start in early fall and has started taking applicants. The class size can be up to 15 people. Starting the program costs $25,000 for curriculum, materials, licensing, and training. The reoccurring cost is less than $2,000 per cohort to cover instructor compensation. It's one of multiple programs offered by Delaware DOC. Others include more familiar work release, GED class, and substance use recovery programs. The launch of RTA's Reimagining Myself in Delaware comes as funding from programs to support individuals leaving prisons ends this year. The state also used these dollars to support case management, supportive housing for probationers, and job training. Benta Boutier, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Benta. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we look ahead to the next performance by the Southern Delaware Chorale. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Southern Delaware Chorale returns to the stage later this month with a concert that deals with two very different regal themes, the crowned heads of Europe and some rock and roll royalty. It's called Kings and Queen, featuring Mozart's Coronation Mass. That's the king's part. And the music of Freddie Mercury. That's the queen part. On this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny learns more about this out-of-the-box concept and the musical threads connecting Mozart and Mercury with Southern Delaware Chorale co-director Joseph Shortall.
So first, tell me a little bit about the chorale and its history, because your origin story ties directly into one of the most famous choral pieces in music, one of my favorite pieces.
Absolutely. So the Southern Delaware Chorale was started 40 years ago as really an opportunity for community members to make music with one another. And Beth Holkhauser was in the area and said, we really need a choral ensemble, and loved the piece, Handel's Messiah. And she said, well, let's put a pickup group together of Handel's Messiah. And that's how the group started. And this idea of community has continued on for the past 40 years. And we have approximately, depending on season, 50 to 90 members in the ensemble each year. For our Messiah performance this past December, we had close to 90. And right now, for our upcoming concerts, we're in the 75 to 80 range. So really, really strong community membership. No auditions are required. It's really just a group of singers that just love to be with one another.
The chorale started with a famous piece of music, and now you're dealing with another pretty famous piece of choral music on this concert. Tell me about the concert, and this is kind of a different approach to Mozart.
Yeah, definitely. So our upcoming concert is called Kings and Queens, and it is a combination of the Mozart Coronation Mass meets Freddie Mercury. And you look at it and you're saying, wow, what's going on here? What crazy person came up with that? And that would be me. And I got this idea really attending a couple Baltimore Symphony Orchestra concerts and seeing all these fusion concerts and saying, well, if the orchestra can do it, why can't a chorus do it as well? So what's going to happen is we're taking the whole mass structure. So you're thinking the Kyrie, the Gloria, the Credo, all six parts of the mass. And then in between certain mass things, there's going to be a Freddie Mercury song. So things that are going to make an appearance, Under Pressure, Somebody to Love, and of course, Bohemian Rhapsody. And then sometimes to help weave the things together, there's going to be a couple musical interludes with some string players and thinking of it almost like a la Bridgerton, like pop song meets classical music to kind of weave the two things together.
And just to go really deep into the music history weeds for a moment, this is kind of in a sense, everything old is new again, because the six parts of the Mass Ordinary, a lot of composers would put other music in between those big parts. So you're dealing with some more contemporary music, but also kind of a well-established tradition, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when we're looking at the Mass parts, you know, there's other things that are happening in the service. And so, you know, while this is definitely sacred meets secular type of things, there is a standard for this. And really, as opposed to driving home maybe in music history where there would be similarities of you know, what's happening during the church cycle, you know, well, whatever's happening that way, what we're doing is we're saying, like, listen, Mozart and Freddie Mercury really pushed the extremes of music during their lifetimes. We're looking at their similarities and how they were innovators for music, and how we can draw on those similarities, the highly dramatic music of Mozart and Freddie Mercury, and trying to draw on those similarities throughout the concert.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because one thing that does unite these two composers is the way that they pushed the boundaries of the music they were working in at the time. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that and maybe give an example or two.
Sure. So both of them were very gifted and talented musicians from a very early age, kind of thinking, you know, prodigal, like just able to make melodies from an early age. You know, Mozart, we think of him writing music as early as 5, 9, 11 years old. But as far as their actual compositions, both of them are really trying to push the vocal boundaries as to what might be possible. So Mozart really will have big leaping lines for their sopranos. And that's kind of something that's unique to him. Also very contrasting as far as dynamic level. So going quite low dynamic wise, and then bring it quite loud throughout. And then Freddie Mercury is also doing something very similar as well. He's pretty iconic for having these massively long, massively huge range. And, you know, for the normal singer, you're like, I can't do that, right? I can't sing what he's doing. And so similarly, when you're looking at like Mozart arias, he's also doing that with sopranos and having these long, luscious lines. And so they have these similarities that create them to be iconic, just kind of doing it in different ways. And then they're also taking different styles of music and trying to incorporate them into their pieces as well. So, you know, you think Bohemian Rhapsody for Freddie Mercury, there's a variety of styles, and there's even operas kind of represented in this multi-movement piece. You know, it's kind of sectioned out to show different styles throughout that work. And then Mozart's doing the same thing. He's taking influences from throughout Europe and trying to create some unique pieces as well. So both composers are really trying to push the limits.
A lot of similarities between the two, but I wonder for the singers, is it difficult to switch styles smoothly?
Yes. Yes. So pretty much my rehearsal is always, let's do some Mozart, let's do some Queen, let's do some Mozart, let's do some Queen. Because you're absolutely right. The styles are different. And essentially you have to kind of have a moment where you just kind of flip a switch and then flip it right back. And you know, their goal is that we are going to try and make the Mozart sound Mozart. And we're going to try and make the Queen sound as Queen as possible and try and make sure that we can flip that switch. So throughout our rehearsal process, it's very much been like, well, what does this sound like? This past week, I was explaining to the ensemble, like, this can't be a full, like, but as we're singing, like, this portion in the music can't be a full voice, oh, type of moment. We have to think of it more like this. And then as soon as we get to this part in the Mozart, we have to change again. So absolutely, it's difficult to navigate, but I think it's really cool, and it's going to be quite engaging to see the differences between the two styles throughout.
One of the things that we've talked about in the classical music world for years, for decades, probably for generations, is how to maintain and increase our audiences. There's a lot of concern about audiences sort of withering away. Are fusion concerts like this part of the pathway forward, do you think?
Well, we're certainly trying. I mean, that is definitely something that we're thinking about. I look at this as an opportunity to hopefully draw connections for communities that may not have originally seen a connection. Like I said on the onset is, you know, you look at this concert and you're like, Queen, Mozart, they're not typically on the same concert, let alone kind of intertwined together throughout the concert. And I think that for so many people, even my own chorale members, I've had some that are like, listen, I really don't like Queen that much. And or listen, Mozart's kind of boring to me. Right. I've had both of those. Right. And so I think the goal is to try and say, that's okay. Like, we can still create a different type of artistic moment. So thinking about having a more of a musical moment, taking two different styles and trying to weave them together with the hope of possibly getting a bigger audience, possibly, you know, letting people see Mozart in a different light, letting people see Freddie Mercury in a different light. And with the idea that maybe this will be the first time that people have ever heard somebody by Mozart, and hope maybe get a few more Mozart lovers out there.
As we talked about a moment ago, Mozart was known for being willing to think outside the box, to sort of subvert the fashionable musical paradigms of the time. What do you think Mozart would have thought of Freddie Mercury?
Ooh, you know, that's a great question. I feel like they both individuals really like to paint outside the box. They both really like to go outside the norms. So I feel like, you know, they might not have been the best of friends, but I think that he might have respected the uniqueness, the individuality that they brought, and the expertise that they each bring to music. So I think that they might not have been the best of friends, but I think that there would have been a mutual respect.
What do you hope audiences will take away from seeing this concert?
You know, I think it's two things. You can find great music in so many different genres and be willing to try and see concerts from any type of arts organization throughout the region. You know, even if you're like, that's not my favorite genre or whatever they're performing, go hear it, right? That's the first thing, is that there's great music in so many different genres. Second is that the arts are really alive and well in Sussex County. And I think it's really cool that you can get some really cool classical music in Sussex County. And then the third thing is really some great community music making. That's really the heart of this ensemble. And I think that Sarah, who's the other director, and I really try and bring this community-based, and I hope that is portrayed in our concerts, that really the singers that are up there love to be up there, and we are trying to consistently just make quality music, but also share the joy that they have for singing with the audience.
Well, Joseph Shortall, thank you so much. Best of luck with this concert.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Southern Delaware Chorale co-director Joseph Shortall for joining our Martin Matheny on this edition of Arts Playlist. The Southern Delaware Chorale presents Kings and Queen on April 26th at the Epworth United Methodist Church in Rehoboth Beach. More information on the performance is available at southerndelawarechorale.org. And we wrap up the green next with Enlighten Me, where we get some tips for backyard gardening as spring arrives in the first state. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. It's that time of year again. The earth is waking up, the first flowers and shoots are blooming, and gardening enthusiasts across the region are flexing their green thumbs as they prepare for another growing season. But with climate change and extreme weather events, the techniques of the past may not be best for the present. On this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Jay Shah is joined by Conchita Gibson, co-founder and president of the Wild Ones Delmarva chapter, to dig into what you can do with your land this spring.
So at this point in the growing season, what preparation should gardeners undertake?
Yeah, I think the biggest heads up that you can give for yourself in your garden is going to be having a general plan of what you want out of your spaces. You don't have to have all the specifics. You can fill those in as you go. But knowing like, okay, this is where is going to be a good spot for veggie gardening. Here's going to be a good spot for some ornamental. I need curb appeal here or there. And then from there, you can fill in your specifics. And especially if you're working in a newer space, if you're starting a newer garden, if you moved in a year ago this year, it's good to take some time to observe your conditions and maybe do some test plants. So, you know, buy some different plants, know what conditions they're needing, and just test them out, put them in different places and see how they do. That kind of design and planning process, designing for maintenance, is something that's really, really key for the future of your garden as well.
This brings to mind this idea of perception. I've heard from other people in conversation with ecologists, biologists, gardening experts, foragers, and conservationists that when we think about making choices about what we want in our yard, it's always the perception that don't go for this plant just because it's pretty. Go for the alternative, which is the native plant. But then there's also those who believe that that perception needs to be reversed, that the native plant shouldn't be the alternative. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's all about perception and it's all about, you know, the worldview that we're taking. There are plenty of native plants that look exactly like the non-native plants. And so I think changing the mindset of like, native plants aren't pretty or native plants aren't, ornamental. They totally are. They totally are. What the problem we run into is that the nursery trade, in order to scale on those large scales and have consistent quality and stock, you know, all the business side of it, it has to be consistent within that model. And so you're getting only a certain number of species, and they have to be able to be cultivated anywhere or shipped anywhere safely and get there and looking nice. And so I think we tend to think, oh, the only thing that's pretty is this, because the opposite is native plants that are in a meadow and they're all really scraggly and weird looking. Where if you're doing it right and if you're choosing the right species for your space, you know, you can put a boxwood anywhere. Does it look great everywhere? It really is up to the people that are looking at it to see. There are some cues that we take as a society of like what is neat versus what is nature and dirty and dangerous, perhaps. You know, we tend to think that, you know, open mulch areas signify. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of... the idea that I'm going to plant a meadow in my front yard, well, you're going to attract snakes. Like, that's going to be a problem, or maybe ticks, or this, or that.
Japanese barberry is a breeding ground for ticks, apparently.
Correct, exactly.
Right.
And this is the perception that you're talking about, is we only know certain amount of information. We only know what's being sold to us effectively with, you know, you don't get a ton of, there are some, you know, landscaping informational things out there. But a lot of the information we get about plants is from the people who are selling them to us, right? And me as a business owner that also sells plants, you know, like I am within that. I totally get that. You got to maintain your business. You want good quality stock. You want things to be consistent quality-wise. You want reliable plants to sell. But flipping that mindset into thinking more like, what if I did shop locally? What if I did take a chance on this plant that, you know, looks a little bit different? Does it have to be a certain way for it to be, you know, for it to be cued to me that, oh, that's a maintained landscape. That's not a maintained landscape, because there are unmaintained areas, but a good meadow is still maintained. You still have to do some stuff to it. Native plants are not set it and forget about it. You do have to it's less maintenance for sure, because what you're doing is creating that balance where you know, you attract the things that maintain themselves, you know, and so there's still a little bit, you know, going back thousands of years, people have been maintaining the landscape. It was never, you know, I always say in some of my business talks, the wild TM, we've been sold this idea that there's people spaces and then there's nature spaces, when in reality, it's all nature spaces. We have just developed over some of those spaces. We still have issues because if we didn't, no one would be worried about attracting snakes or attracting ticks, right? So I think what we try to do with Wild Ones Del Marva is to address some of these perceptions, some of these cultural ideas that we've been told, that we've searched on the internet, that we've been sold through different means and such, and really try to give people the information to make their own good choices. And I do that through my business as well. Like, I'm not here to tell you what you should do, to police your consumer choices, things like that. What I take my job is to share as much information, give you all the different options, tell you real talk what's happening. If you put this in your garden, what's going to happen? What have I seen? What have other people seen? What ends up being the long-term, you know, not, I guess, consequences, but once you change a variable in a system, all the other variables will respond to it. And so
there is really impact regardless of what you do, right?
Exactly. And so, you know, obviously through Wild Ones, we push native plants because they provide the most benefits, the most balanced ecosystem. You might get a snake in your yard, but you'll also get the predator that comes in and eats it pretty quickly, right? So you're and predator, I mean, like a bird, like an owl, right? So it's hard, you know, we will never be able to create sterilized spaces outside. You can't, it's just not possible. Unless you are also, unless your house is in like a glass bubble, right? Like if it's outside, it becomes part of the system. So what can you do with your plant choices, with the information that you're able to find, with knowing what's around your house? Do you have a lot of snakes? Do you have foxes? Do you have, you know, anything else you can think of, and then addressing things in a way that is holistic and balances what you've got outside.
So springtime is definitely, it seems like a good time to do all of this, you know, pre-planning, hard work on a computer or just like through books and whatnot, because this isn't necessarily the time where you start rushing to plant everyone into the ground because the season is just beginning, right?
Yeah, you can. There are some species that flower, any of the species that flower early, flower in the spring, is you do want to plant those in the spring just because by the end of the season, they're kind of spent on energy and it can be stressful. You can plant them, but their availability actually may not even be around because they're, you know, kind of spent for the year. So anything that blooms earlier is always a good option for planting in the spring. Fall is a really, I feel like, a little underestimated great time to plant though, because it's after the heat of the summer. You plant them in, they have some acclimation time, and then they go dormant in the winter time, which is what they need to sleep anyway. And now they've got a good rest before they, you know, start growing again next year. I'll mention the research right now, climate wise, is indicating we are going to have a really strong El Nino this year. And El Nino in our area tends to bring very hot, very dry, very droughty. And if it's as bad as they're currently projecting, it's gonna be a long one, and it's gonna be pretty gnarly, and it's gonna be really tough. So I would personally, from my business side of the house, I would recommend planting earlier this year if you can, maybe till the second week of May, because if we get an early El Nino in June, that's going to be really tough for new plants as they're getting acclimated. You know, it takes 2, 3, 4 weeks for the initial acclimation period, but that first year is important for plants for long-term health. Even our native plants that can tolerate, you know, our native plants are used to, you know, I say used to, but El Ninos and La Ninas and such. But it can still, with as bad of as El Nino as it's looking like, it might be better to get your spring planting done this year in particular by that second full week of May. And then just let things acclimate, and anything you didn't get to, save it for the fall once the drought breaks.
Right. And I was about to ask, how do they save the ones that they couldn't get into the ground, in containers or a greenhouse or their basement?
Yeah. With native plants, it's a little tougher. Just because they're not indoor plants. You could try, you know, they still need the sun requirements that they have. If you don't get to them, they might also root out in your container. So you might just have to like pop them up and kind of baby them a little bit. If you don't get to them by the middle of May, I'd say still get them in the ground and just baby them in the ground. That might be easier on them than keeping them like, you know, in
what do you mean by babying them? Because I'm imagining carrying them around in a stroller.
Which that is definitely like my aesthetic too.
Like a proud parent.
Yeah, keeping a close eye on them, making sure they have water frequently. It's not necessarily like the amount of water. You don't want to like extra water them just once a week or something. It would be frequent water, and then really observing them. And even still, and during that acclimation period, I've had I've had a few plants that have just gotten real cranky after they get planted. They drop all their leaves and get real dramatic and go away. And then in a few weeks, they're actually back and they're fine. I would say don't be scared if your plants seem like they have died, especially your native plants. The non-native plants, they're not as hardy and used to our weather. And so that might be more of a challenge. If it's a boxwood and it throws all its leaves, that might actually be an issue because they're not really supposed to do that. But a lot of our native grasses, native flowering plants, mm-hmm. they sometimes will just throw their leaves off and have a fit and then come back okay in a few weeks, next season, next year. So going back to your mindset, the perception, it's important to remember too, you can think about it as buying individual plants and then keeping those individual plants. Or you can think about it as buying a set of plants to create a garden and seeing the garden as a whole. And you might lose one plant over here, but this one might spread. And now that's your garden, right? So thinking about it less as I bought a thing, I need to keep the thing alive. And thinking about it as I bought a bunch of things to create a space that is going to be a living mm-hmm. grouping of plants. Makes it a little more tolerable. Yes. Yeah. It makes it easier when something does die.
Thanks to Conchita Gibson, co-founder and president of the Wild Ones Delmarva chapter, and RJ Shah for enlightening us this week. You can hear more of their conversation on the Greens page at DelawarePublic.org. And we want to know what you're planting this year. Let us know by emailing thegreen@DelawarePublic.org. You can also email us there if you have a specific question or topic about gardening you'd like us to delve into. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Benta Boutier, Israel Hale, and Martin Matheny, along with our producer, Jay Shah. for all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsing. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.